author Stephanie Powell Watts writes about the working class, the uneducated, the aspiring, Southerners she's encountered in her own life as a Southerner. In her Pushcart Prize-winning short story, Unassigned Territory, she draws upon experience as a Jehovah's Witness, preaching along the winding dirt roads way out in the boonies, where mostly white Southerners have been holed up for generations. Out there, one passes the occasional mansion, trailers and shacks out of sight from each other, where everyone and his dog has a dog. As her character goes along, instead of recording converts' names in her ledger, she instead scribbles private notes to Dr. Martin Luther King and poet Philip Larkin. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and a Southern author joins us to share her stories, plus her short stories. That's coming up on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. It's a realm of dirt roads and stray animals with personality. A place of simple folks traversing through unassigned territory, dreaming of city life, embarking upon summers of love, and of course, wanting for a lot, but taking only what they need. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guest today creates and recreates this Southern world in a collection of short stories called We Are Taking Only What We Need. A finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award, she's an assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. Stephanie Powell Watts, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about the title of your book, We Are Taking Only What We Need, taken from the title of one of the stories. What does that phrase mean?
I thought of this title, originally the title of the book was Unassigned Territory, because I was really interested in the isolation and the alienation that you feel, or that my characters felt. And they're all trying to find themselves, all trying to figure out where their territory is and why they are unassigned. But I thought that this title captured better what I felt like that the characters were trying to pursue. The other title was who they are and where they were, but this is what they were trying to pursue. And they were trying to get out the best way they could, their circumstances, their lot in life, and they were just taking the things that they could carry with them after the fire, just what they needed.
This is set mostly in rural North Carolina. What was it like growing up in rural North Carolina?
I loved North Carolina. I still love North Carolina, and most of my family is still there. I lived in, if you know North Carolina, you know the Asheville area, the mountains, and that's a kind of glitzy, beautiful part of North Carolina. It's all beautiful as far as the landscape is concerned, but there's a different part where there are mill towns and where the furniture factories were and where the blue-collar people live, and that's where I'm from. One of the mill towns, Lenore, is famous actually for furniture. If you've ever seen The Price is Right, most of their furniture, at least back in the day, used to come from my town. Bernhardt and Roy Hill and those big names. And that's what everybody in my family did at one time or another. I worked at a furniture factory for a summer, for a short time. And everybody did it. That's just what you did until all of those jobs left. And they've mostly been sent overseas. But that's the area that I come from. Still beautiful, still picturesque, still lovely and Southern and Gothic and all of those things you think about when you think about the South, but very much a working class South.
Most of your characters are what you call dirt roaders, working mm-hmm. class, uneducated mm-hmm. but smart, and you say hoping to get smarter. Mm-hmm. What makes these characters unique?
I think that with Southern literature, I think that there's this kind of pluckiness, maybe that's not the right word, but kind of spark to the characters. They want something else. They're not trying to deny who they are and where they come from, and in fact they're proud of it, but they want to see something else. They know that there's another world out there that they're not being privy to for whatever reason, and they want that. They want knowledge, and so I think that there's that strong drive in all of these characters in the book.
We find throughout the collection that many of the accounts are first person, mm-hmm. told through the voice of a young woman. Tell us mm-hmm. about why you made that choice.
There's a I love first person. It's so intimate. I feel like that I really got into the character, got into the minds of the characters. And there are so many of these feelings and emotions and these states of being that I have felt myself. These characters are not me, but they're some iteration of me, some version of me, some kind of me that I wanted to reproduce in the pages. And so I use first person a lot, not exclusively. There are a couple of third person stories, but for the most part, I really wanted the intimacy of that voice.
What do you find to be the different approaches with using an omniscient third person versus a first person account?
I just the first person, I feel like that you have to know that person inside and out. And I don't think there's any reason in the world to use a first person narration unless the character has a real voice. Unless that is a voice that's speaking to you, just like if you called up a friend, you know that person's voice. And if that character doesn't have that voice, that real sound and quality and even timbre to the way that he or she speaks, in this case she speaks, you don't need first person.
Right, because the first person isn't necessarily, the sky was picturesque. You know,
right.
It's more of a granular approach.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I love omniscience. I think that there's that sometimes get the omniscient voice gets called old fashioned or underrated. I mean, there's really something beautiful about someone who knows something that can tell you. They can just say, "She was a wicked woman," and you say, "Okay, that's the voice that knows. So I understand that woman now." So.
In the title story, we are taking only what we need. It's the title of a short story as well as the title of this collection. We should remind our listeners, in that same title story, a daughter forced to grow up quick with a stoic and secretive and gruff father. Something jumps off the page on that. The phrase, love requires tribute. Talk about that. Why does love require tribute in this story, in this dirt road country? And how did you mine that phrase out?
Oh, that's a great question. I think that sometimes that we think, or maybe at least I think, that love is passive, and that it doesn't that you can just say I love someone and that's it, and you don't have to do anything. There doesn't have to be a reciprocal kind of agreement that's made between you and the person that you love. And I think there always is, and not only that, but that it has to be celebrated in some way. And the daughter in this story, she realizes through all kinds of convoluted things that happen in the story, that her love for her father is unconditional and it needs to be celebrated. And she forgot that, even when he's doing things that that she doesn't like, she doesn't agree with, that even are frightening to her, that is something that needs to be celebrated.
Well, speaking of that story, let's hear an excerpt from the title story, We're Taking Only What We Need, taken from the collection, We Are Taking Only What We Need. The author is Stephanie Powell Watts. What are we hearing about in this passage? Set it up for us.
Okay, this is the beginning of the story. And in this opening, I wanted to set up the idea that there are fragile things, small things that need our care. And in this case, they're dogs. And the narrator talks about how important these dogs are to the family and ultimately to the story, but that these fragile things need our care, and we need to figure out how the best way to take care of these things is, what the best way is. And so that's the sort of opening that for this story. In my father's house, there were many dogs, or at least the memory of dogs. Brown or garbage gray, with slick short hair, fully grown things with generic faces, like a child's cartoon idea of dog. We call them end-of-the-liners, last-dazers, apocalypse dogs. These dogs didn't bother to bond with us, but stuck out their paws, not to shake hands, but so we could slit their wrists and get it the hell over with. All of them were mutts, every last one. Nobody dropped his beloved purebred on our Carolina dirt road in the middle of the night. There were puppies, not many, but a few curly-haired sweet things with lying round faces that betrayed us every time they peed all over the rug or kept us up with their crying, their baying, their inconsolable whining for the loss of a body warm with the familiar stank of their own. A few of them came to us intentionally from the hands of desperate neighbors who couldn't stand to drown the whole litter if there was another way. but most were unlucky and landed on my daddy's land, as unplanned as his children, and just as one shoulder shrug tolerated. We are not cruel. We are country. We don't heart dogs. You aren't likely to see a black country woman's dog in a Christmas sweater. We are not dog mommies. Nobody goes out of their way to get called a name. We know that God intended dogs to live outside in the relative wild by their cunning, instincts, and not by whatever faith they put in us. My people don't need reminding that God might love the sparrow, but the dirty mutt feeds for himself. Dogs might spend some sad days in search of cool or shelter under a sagging porch, but not in the house, not beside us on the sheets, not with their rough tongues on our faces, not in any communion that feels set apart, just us, just us. In my father's house, no dog got more love than a day.
That's an excerpt, a passage from We Are Taking Only What We Need. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. The reader of that passage and writer of that passage, creator of that passage, is our guest today, Stephanie Powell Watts, an author and assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. We are talking about her collection of short stories titled We Are Taking Only What We Need, a finalist, by the way, for the Penn Hemingway Award. These are some very interesting and curious titles for some of these stories, these fictional pieces, such as There Can Never Be Another Me, Family, Museum of Ancient Postcards, If You Hit Randolph County, You've Gone Too Far, and of course, the title story, We're Taking Only What We Need, about dogs, love, underage affairs, a daughter's love for her dad that demands tribute. Where did you get these titles for your different stories? How do you decide to name your story?
Oh, yeah. That's a great question. And titles are so hard. That's been the bane of my existence as a writer. But some of the titles just come to me. And it's usually after the story is done. I've rarely had a title for a story that I'm in the middle of or I've just started. But if you hit Randolph County, you've gone too far. I set the story in Randolph County, Randolph County, North Carolina. So that started the story. But I just wanted to suggest that there was a limit that the character in this case, early middle-aged woman. I just wanted to say there's a limit to what she can stand, even in her own family. And so this place that is Randolph County is also a state of mind for her. And she just couldn't. This is as much as she could take. That's it. And so that's how that title came about. The Family Museum of the Ancient Postcards. I really expected when it was first published for the publisher, the editor, to ask me for another title. But I love the title. I was actually in Prague, and I saw I went to this exhibit of postcards, and it was Family Museum, and there were ancient postcards, and there were all of these family pictures of ordinary events that were really wonderful, and they told a story in this remarkable way, these were actually not photographs but drawings. And I just love the simple line drawings. I love the way it told this really visceral, interesting story. So I thought it might work for the story that I was trying to tell. But titles are awful.
So you supposed when you wrote that story, what if Aunt Jenny had a postcard to tell her story?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's a really good point.
And another one of your stories that you originally intended for the whole collection to be titled Unassigned Territory. We learn about the adventures of a reluctant young Jehovah's Witness. You happen to be a Jehovah's Witness. Tell us about the real Stephanie Powell Watts and this character and how you infuse the role of race and religion into this rural North Carolina setting. Tell us about that.
Okay, I'd love to. This I was a Jehovah's Witness for most of my adolescence and into my 20s. I was an active minister. I went door to door. I was one of those people who came to your door, offering magazines, and I very much enjoyed that time of my life, and I very much enjoyed doing that. And in some ways, it seems like the hardest part of being a Jehovah's Witness, but once you do it, it really becomes easy because you have in your mind that you are bringing people good news, and that you can change, you can at least help change their lives. So it's a remarkable feeling that when you're knocking on the door, that it's an opportunity to help change and shape someone's life. And if you believe that, if you really have that kind of faith, you can stand some slammed doors and some people calling you names. You know, you don't like it, but you can take it because you know you're doing the right thing. So without that conviction, if you've had that conviction and you know the direction of your life and you understand who you are, what happens when you don't have it anymore? Then what's your path? What direction do you take? Who are you then? And in this story, here's a character who is just embarking on this idea that maybe she doesn't have that conviction anymore, and she has to figure out what she's going to do next. And that scares the devil out of her. She does not know how to think about even herself.
So it's literal and figurative, unassigned territory.
Yeah, yeah.
It's different to walk from door to door in an urban setting.
Mm-hmm.
But this character is out on dirt roads where there are no other black people, plus she's a Jehovah's Witness.
That's right.
So talk about that.
Yeah, yeah. And I've done that. And it's amazing. It's remarkable. Most of the people that you meet in the unassigned territory are white people, at least in North Carolina. And unassigned territory is basically that territory that people don't work that often, that ministers don't go door to door very often.
And you were a pioneer.
Yes, I was.
That's the actual name for it.
That's right.
Literally.
That's right. that's exactly right. And so these people don't see you, Jehovah's Witnesses, for a couple years, sometimes 3 years, because you just can't get out there that often because you're so busy working the territory that's right around you. And so they're very surprised, and you can imagine how surprised they are when they see a black woman on the at the door.
Right. There's a sense of awe.
Right.
She's
right.
Actually coming to the house.
That's right. Why? Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting, and the area itself is frightening and beautiful, you know, because it's so overgrown and you know, when you don't know where you are, and there are these winding dirt roads, and you can't imagine how frightening that might be. And it's unassigned. People don't come up there very often. So
you get a sort of a sense of a biblical atmosphere of the wilderness.
Yes.
And a person walking from house to house, preaching the good news, as it were. But you mentioned that there's this sort of crises of faith that this character mm-hmm. has in the story Unassigned Territory, with wrestling with being a Jehovah's Witness,
mm-hmm.
and you had that in your own life. Talk
yes.
about how that works into it, even as she's out there on the road, even as you were out there on the road.
That's right. That's right. That I had at this time in my life, I did not have the Stephanie in the story. I complicate matters by naming my main character Stephanie, and of course that's my name. But at this time in my life, I was not feeling as she's feeling. That came later for me, and much more gradually. But this character is feeling like she doesn't know what her next step is going to be. Literally, she the man that many want her to marry. She's only 17, but many are looking to for her wedding soon. They don't want her. Many don't want her to go to college. They would rather her do something else with her life, and namely, be a minister. And so she's really wrestling with that, and she doesn't know what to do. At that time in my life, I wasn't so much. I really understood that this was a path for me, and so that I wasn't feeling that so much. But that crisis came to me and comes to me all the time.
This character is really on a search
mm-hmm.
in all sense of the words. Why does the character end up writing a letter to Martin Luther King and the poet Philip Larkin? What's the motivation there? Did you do that when you were out on the road, write letters to people?
I didn't do exactly that, but there are house-to-house records that you need to keep.
And instead of keeping those records, she just ended up writing these letters.
I would write notes, but I wouldn't write, you know, the whole letters. But I'd write notes to myself, and sometimes my notes were more colorful than probably needed be. But I didn't do exactly that. But she writes that because she's trying to write out her her struggle at the same time. And these are two figures that loom large for her. One is an artistic figure, and he happens not to be someone who is affiliated with faith, Philip Larkin, but he's such a large figure to her because he's a beautiful writer, and that's important. And in some ways, that writing is like a religious calling to him. So that's important. And then Martin Luther King Jr., he looms large in for her because he is like the god of her generation and her parents' generation. You know, his voice is important. What he stood for is important. And she wants to be a part of that, but she doesn't quite know how to ingratiate herself into that world.
She wants to tell him about how his dream may or may not have come to fruition.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
In another one of your stories, Welcome to the City of Dreams, we move out of the rural atmosphere, mm-hmm. and you begin to describe Raleigh, North Carolina, mm-hmm. almost like it's the Shangri-La compared to the rural dirt country. Is that how you saw it, or did you make that adjustment simply for your characters?
There's definitely an element of that. When I remember going to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, for the first time and seeing, and I'm sure I probably went before them, but I just don't remember it. But seeing the wide roads, the highway, there are lines of stores. You know, I mean, it sounds all very mundane and kind of ridiculous. But I remember feeling that there's a way to live that's different than the way that I've known.
Like, oh my God, paved roads,
right?
Apartments that are right next to each other.
I don't mean to sound like Jethro, but it's,
but
you
do get that feeling.
I did.
Called Raleigh, North Carolina, the city of dreams.
I know. I did have that feeling, but it's really true. I did.
Why was it the city of dreams for these characters?
Because it felt like that you could start over, and that's I mean, that's a dream, I guess, that people have had forever, that they could start over and be somebody else. That if I just had another start, another landscape, I could be somebody else. But of course, that you always take yourself, right? So of course, that doesn't happen. But that makes it this kind of Shangri-La, they call it.
Well, Kansas City is a big city to some people who have moved from points south.
Right.
And now would be a good time to ask our Kansas City listeners, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. How have your southern roots shaped you here in this big city? As we talk to the author, Stephanie Powell Watts, about her experiences in rural America and then coming to cities, 816-235-2888. Once again, the number is 816-235-2888. How have your southern roots, Kansas City, shaped you, shaped your life, shaped your worldview, shaped everything? And you can also write into us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Looking forward to you joining the conversation, Kansas City. Now, Stephanie, you said that people make assumptions about Southerners.
Mm-hmm.
What are those assumptions?
There are a number of them. I was just reading a couple of days ago this quote by Pat Conroy's mom, and she said that Southerners and Southern literature can be summed up this way. She said, when Willie got ate by the hogs, Mama died because she learned what Daddy done to sister. And I love
wow.
that. I love that quote, because that really does feel like what people think about Southern literature, that it's this morass of craziness, of all of these secrets, and particularly family secrets, on top of ignorance, you know. And so that feels like what people are assuming when they come to Southern literature. And there are obviously some things that ring true. There's a lot of Southern literature about family. And in family, you don't have family without secrets. You don't have family without those stories that people wish hadn't been told or that they didn't have to know.
With a lot of Southern writers and Southern literature, Southern writers who move north, you find in their works mm-hmm. either that cautionary tale, that cautionary disdain for their place of origin, the secrets, the racial hatred,
mm-hmm.
the gender discrimination, the high society versus the poor. And you find that they really didn't like being there
mm-hmm.
in retrospect. And then on the other side, there's a really romantic notion of growing up in the South, magnolia trees, bayous, mm-hmm. and all that. Your account, though, seems to be neutral. Why do you think that is?
I'm not sure. There's I did love the South, but it's hard not to love it. It's my home. But to say that there are no racial problems, to say that there that I didn't experience the kinds of things that you've just mentioned, the kinds of discrimination, to say that there isn't a kind of class system that is now that now includes also Hispanic people is crazy and defies the obvious. But it's home. It's hard not to at least have some kind of fondness for it.
Our guest is Stephanie Powell Watts. She's an author and assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. We're discussing her collection of short stories titled We Are Taking Only What We Need. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more about her writing process and the inspiration for some of her stories, as well as her views on being a black writer in modern times. Meanwhile, Casey, are you from the South? How has your background as a Southerner, even if it's Southern Missouri, how has that background shaped you? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you can also write in your thoughts at centralstandard@kcur.org or on Twitter at KCURCST. Y'all come back now, you hear? And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest today is Stephanie Powell Watts, who says that when it comes to storytelling, one can be a writer and try to present the world in all its flawed complexity, or they'll stop writing anything more than a substantive holiday card or a snazzy email. We welcome back Stephanie Powell Watts for the second part of the hour. She's an author and assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. We're discussing her collection of short stories titled We Are Taking Only What We Need, mostly set in rural North Carolina and told with a sassy, whimsical flair that just about anybody can relate to. Kansas City, what are your Southern roots and how have they shaped you? Are you from the South, even if it's Southern Missouri? How's that background shaped you? 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you can write in at centralstandard@kcur.org or tweet us, as in a bird in the tree. Tweet us on Twitter at KCURCST. Tell us about your Southern roots and how they shape your worldview as we discuss rural North Carolina, the fictional and non-fictional worlds that shape our guest's life and worldview. Let's start with that statement you made, Stephanie. Presenting the world in all its flawed complexity, which you do admirably in this collection, by the way. Is it a writer's opinion to do that, to avoid the holiday card or snazzy email sensibility?
I think so. Yeah, I think you're trying so hard to create a real person on the page. And, you know, sometimes we're all quippy and fun and, you know, that's part of being who we are, too. So I'm not putting down the holiday card. I'm just saying that that's not all that we are. And we really want to read about the lives of other people. That's what we're dying to find out, how other people get through and get over and do it, you know. And so that's what I'm trying to do, to create some real people.
I'm thinking of a title for a short story collection, Holiday Cards and Snazzy Emails. sort of the ironic title that you have. And it's all about pathos and macabre. You grew up in North Carolina and ended up doing post-grad work at MU. How did you find the culture of the state of Missouri compared to where you're from?
So many people told me that you're staying in the South, that Missouri is the South. But I just didn't feel like that Missouri is the South. And of course, I was in Columbia. It's a college town. It's very different. There are lots of people from all over the place. I was in graduate school, and the mix is even greater in graduate school. So there, but it just did not feel like the South that I was used to. People carried themselves differently. They spoke differently, not just the accent, but it just didn't feel like the South that I knew.
Why not?
I think that there's a kind of I hope my Southern friends will forgive me for this, but there's kind of an oppression that you feel in the South.
It's in the weather, as my grandmother used to say. It's in the clouds.
Yes,
it's in the air.
Yes. There is definitely that, you know, and it is both figurative and literal. And I felt like, for example, there's a department store in the South called Belk. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I remember going there. I'd just become a PhD. I was feeling kind of good about myself, and I was being followed around by one of the salespeople. And maybe that could have happened in Missouri. Maybe it could have happened anywhere. But I was, you know, I was clean at least. Maybe not well-dressed, but clean. I don't think of myself as a threatening person. I'm 5'2". So I just felt that immediately, that I'm being watched, I'm being scrutinized, I'm being judged. And there's a lot of that I didn't feel, and it could just be that I wasn't in the places that are more specifically related to the South, or that people talk about are Southern.
We have Steve and Liberty. We're talking about one's Southern roots and how they shaped your life. Steve, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. And it's so good to talk to somebody that knows how to talk right. I appreciate that.
All right.
I was born across the mountains there near Knoxville, but I used to live right outside of Shelby in Kings Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
If you were familiar with that area.
Oh, yeah.
A couple of comments of what you say. I think you're right. I think that there are different areas within the South where there are just different cultures and the way people look at things. I know there was one place up in Tennessee. I lived there for over 5 years, but I was still considered a foreigner. I was
foreigner.
Not born there. And so I was never, and I can go back there now, and they'll be nice and cordial and warmly welcome me, but I'm still a foreigner.
That's
I will
right.
never be one of them.
Yeah, that's right.
Secondly, I can remember one day we lived right outside of Blacksburg, South Carolina. We had a Jehovah Witness lady come by, and we invited her in and spent a long time visiting with her about her premillennialist and postmillennialist ideas and thoughts at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The one question I have, which is totally unrelated to your topic, however, is in your travels out there in the back roads, did you ever get up toward Lincolnton and the theories and the idea that that is actually where Abraham Lincoln was born?
Wow.
I have never heard that. I've been to Lincolnton, but I've never heard that.
Well, a friend of mine was doing some genealogy study. She was big into that, and she found some of the ruins of the cabin that his family was in prior to their move to Kentucky, where he is traditionally perceived as being born. But that is the history that I heard of why Lincolnton and how Lincolnton got its name.
Oh, wow. No, I've never heard that. You know, North Carolina, we are in a dispute already with the Wright brothers. We can't get into a dispute with Lincoln, I don't think.
Thank you, Steve from Liberty, for your contribution to the conversation on Southern roots. And as you know, if you have Southern roots, what Southern people know is conversation.
That's right.
TR in Fort Leavenworth.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning, sir. I'm a Southerner and proud of it. I was farmers and all that other stuff. I have a quick question for you, lady. I know she's well educated. I can just tell by her voice and all. So am I. I was reared on the farm, but in the Army, just a combat soldier and so forth. Came back, finished all of my degrees, doctorate and all that. And I'm a therapist right now. So I watch, and also I'm connected with a church, but I won't give a name of that. But I'm reading a book now. It says, "I has not seen," and in this book, it talks about women. For an example, and I know is she Jehovah's Witness? Is that correct?
Yes, I used to be.
Okay,
she used to be.
My big question, and I don't know how to answer that. What is there women's theology? For an example, I know that the Old and the New Testament talks about. Mainly about men, and I was just wondering why chapters hadn't been written by females, because as far as I'm concerned, you and I and everybody that's living on this world came in this world, born in this world through women, but we sort of place women on the Lord of totem pole, and to me I don't think what kind of a God is going to have superiority with men and then just design means whereby the only way we can be born is through a woman.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, TR, for that. That is a very interesting jump-off point for a conversation, the role of women in religion and spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Yeah, there's typically the roles of women in the churches and the organizations that I've been a part of is the kind of keeper of the light. You know, you're the home front, but not always. For example, my grandmother was a preacher, and she was very much in the woman's preaching kind of tradition. She was not the bringer of knowledge or the giver of knowledge, but she was the sharer. You know, she would stand up and say, this is what God has done for me. This is how I have been a sinner and how I've reformed. Let me tell you the story. Let me tell you about my redemption, that kind of thing. And that's very much in the woman's tradition of preaching. So it's been the Bible talks about the women being a strong army, and they certainly are in religious tradition, and certainly in the traditions that I've been a part of.
And they are a strong army of conversationalists in your book. Getting back to that, we're taking only what we need, a collection of short stories. A great deal of your stories, including one called Black Power, seem autobiographical in mm-hmm. their attention to detail and intimacy. Talk about that. How does a fictionalized account give your experiences an edge? For instance, you worked at a dog kennel.
I did. I worked for a dog for a registry, and I worked on the phone line, and people would call in and they'd tell me their problems about getting their dogs registered. And these were purebred dogs, and people had paid a lot of money for them. So when they didn't look like the dog in the commercial or the beautiful dog that they expected the dog to look like, they were really upset, and so they wanted investigations done. And we actually did some investigations to find out if the dog is truly purebred. So all of that brought up to me these whole ideas, and this registry is in the South, this whole idea about what does pure mean? What is race? Why is it so important to be pure, right? What does that mean? And especially in the context of the South. And so this character is trying to figure some of that out, and she's one of the people that you'd call into.
And the character gets some interesting phone calls.
Yes, she does.
One of which is from a drug dealer.
Right.
What was that about? Tell our listeners what that was about.
Well, I did do this job. I didn't have some of the experiences. One of the experiences, though, someone who sat next to me did actually have. But the drug dealer calls in, and he's gotten this dog through some crazy means, and he wants to get it registered. And, of course, you can't do that. You have to be very particular about these papers because it's very important to keep the lines pure. And he explains this to her, and he tells her very reasonably where he got this dog through this crazy drug life. And she tries to tell him about maintaining purity and about keeping the lines pure. And, you know, the part of that realization dawns on her how ridiculous that is, and how ridiculous what she's doing is and talking to this person is. And so she comes to a number of conclusions about that when talking to this caller.
And you're able to mix in that sort of larger metaphor about pure breeding and mm-hmm. keeping the lines clean, mm-hmm. keeping the breeds clean and all of that. And it's mm-hmm. very interesting juxtaposition that you have there. To what extent did the odd jobs, you mentioned working at a furniture factory mm-hmm. too, to what extent did the odd jobs you had growing up serve as inspiration for a lot of these stories?
There's a lot of inspiration. I mean, there's direct inspiration. I met a number of really fascinating people that show up in smaller or larger parts of my stories, some of these stories and other stories that I've written. So there's that. But also just the idea of working, what people have to do to make it every day. And some people don't have the luxury of even sitting behind a desk. I remember when I was growing up, that was the goal, to have a desk job, to have a job where you had to dress up every day and put on good shoes. It was a real goal, not to be in the factory, not to be on a line, not to be getting dirty. But a lot of people work at those jobs. And so how do they feel about it? Who are they? What do they think about their lives? That was all really important and interesting to me.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR FM, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Stephanie Powell Watts, who's also an assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. We're talking about her collection of short stories titled We Are Taking Only What We Need, which was a finalist for the Penn Hemingway Award. We're also talking about growing up in the South and race and gender and religion and all the hot button topics that make these types of stories very interesting. She'll be doing a book signing tonight at 7 p.m. at the American Jazz Museum Atrium at 1616 18th Street in the 18th and Vine District here in Kansas City. You have another excerpt for us to read here. Tell us about it. Set it up for us.
This is the story Family Museum of the Ancient Postcards. And this is a story I wanted to explore, a story about female friendships. And I wanted to do it from the voice of an adolescent. And so this is a story about a female friendship, an older woman. She's not really older. She's just older to the teenager. She's 41, so that's old to a teenager, but obviously not really old. And a younger woman, she's 14. And so they are the kind of outcasts and the strange ones in their family. And so they connect and they have this bond over over about a summer. And the younger, the older woman, the beginning of the story, talks a little bit about the older woman and who she is. Family Museum of the Ancient Postcards. In April 1976, my Uncle Silas on my daddy's side got out of jail early after 2 years and 5 months of time served for arson. We welcomed him with dinners and back slaps, ignored the pink guilty splotches on his face, places on his skin that would never fully heal, regarded him with a child's wonder, his disappearing act a magic trick. Now you don't, but now you do see him. July 76 was the bicentennial for white people, and though we agreed with our black Muslim cousin and black nationalist neighbor, who's 200 years of freedom? We all marveled at the fireworks in town, bigger and better than usual, some of us with our arms crossed over our chest in protest, but all of us with our faces tilted to the clear summer sky. But most remarkably, late in that year, 41-year-old Jenny Harshaw, my mother's aunt's child, my cousin, though I called her Aunt Jenny, found a husband. We'd given up on her long, long ago. But just when she had ceased to be a change, a variable in the world, Aunt Jenny shocked us with Gerald, 5 foot, maybe a little more, with a big round belly, taut as a starving child's. Though Aunt Jenny was an imposing woman, tall and big-boned, a woman's beautiful. Her cheekbones, the women said. Her long fingers, like a pianist, they said. No man ever noticed. Apparently, except for Gerald. Our family talked. My mother, her sisters and brothers, wives of brothers, everyone had something to say about Aunt Jenny and Gerald. But none of our mocking importance or our jokes made Aunt Jenny twist in shame or doubt the certainty of her mind. Nothing stopped her from rushing like a teenager out her mama's door when Gerald's Grand Torino rattled up the drive. He's not afraid, she said. And neither was she, as she launched herself into the world, sprung and released like a sharp stone from a slingshot. After all those years of living with her mother and her dead father, gone now for 25 of those years, she finally flew the coop. On the way out the door, her hard suitcase on the porch already, pillows of summer clothes packed in the trunk of Gerald's car, she bent to her mother's chair. Her mother's black hair tickled Aunt Jenny's face. "Bye, Mama," she said. Once on the porch, she threw a kiss to her father. "Thank you, merciful God," she said aloud. At that same moment, she thought she'd never again have to hear her father's dead steps in the attic or behind her. No more heavy breath, sour from old cigarettes lingering in the dark places of that creaky house he'd put together with his own hands. It's enough, she thought, not sure if what she felt was an ecstasy. Poor Aunt Jenny. She didn't know, how could she, how dangerous and foolish it is to count on anything for the rest of your life.
That's from an excerpt of Family Museum for Ancient Postcards, a short story that's part of the collection, We Are Taking Only What We Need, written by our guest, read by our guest, Stephanie Powell Watts, an author and assistant professor of English at Lehigh University, who's here and from North Carolina. Most of the stories take place in North Carolina.
Yes.
Ellen, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks. I moved here from North Carolina about a year ago.
So wow, what a coincidence.
Particularly interesting to me. And a couple of things, by the way, I lived in many areas of North Carolina, Rutherford County.
Okay, great.
I went to school in Chapel Hill.
Oh, you did. Oh, I love Chapel Hill.
spent many years in Raleigh and also in Asheville. Uh-huh. And a couple of things. First of all, Rutherford County also lays claim to being the birthplace of Abraham Lincoln.
Oh, my goodness.
But a couple of other things. Your story about having a salesperson follow you around, I had that happen to many of my African-American friends, mm-hmm. and it was always so shocking when they would share that with me.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I've noticed, and let me know your thoughts about this, a couple of differences between the Midwest and the South, and I think that there's a tremendous difference in sense of humor. Do you notice that?
I don't know that I do. I think that there are some inside jokes that Southerners have. When I was in Memphis, I was talking to a woman who was talking about another woman who was from Michigan, and she said, she doesn't get it. She's not one of us. And I do think that there is that element of it, of the inside joke.
Right. Right. I don't know. I think that Southerners, we can certainly tell a story.
Uh-huh.
There's no doubt about it. And we have license to embellish, too, a little bit, if it makes the story better.
Well, of course, yeah.
Yes. And also the cooking. You know, there's definitely a difference in the food,
mm-hmm.
and also I think work ethic. I think it's completely different here with work ethic. Not to say that Southerners don't work hard, because we certainly do, but there's just something a little different about the work ethic here.
Have you
noticed that?
How do you mean?
It's almost like working is a way of life here. And in North Carolina, it was more of something you do from 9 to 5.
I guess I could see what you mean. So many of the people that I know and that I knew when I was in North Carolina worked at jobs that were just not things you really want to talk about. And so your life has to be something else. You know, your family, your food, your gossip, that kind of thing. So who wants, you know, nobody wanted to talk about working very hard in a factory or something like that. So at least in that way, I can see exactly what you mean.
Thank you, Ellen, for contributing to the conversation. By the way, I think you have a new literary subject to tackle. Is Lincoln, in fact, from North Carolina?
I know.
I see some great fictional angles around that, research, everything, how that would change the course of history. Very, very interesting.
That's right.
Speaking of history, you said that you're happy that your generation of African-American writers might be the first not to have the burden of representation cloud over their every word. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like the pressure to present the black or the black woman experience has lessened in modern times?
Oh, I think definitely. I don't think there's any question, at least for me, that it's much less than a person of my mother's generation. There was a whole group of African-American writers about 20, 25 years ago, Alice Walker and Gloria Naylor and Toni Morrison, who were writing, of course, before then and have since been writing and are still those icons of literature, but they started writing from a very different perspective than I do, and my topics are post-integrationist. There's not the direct kind of racial engagement and racist engagement that I've had to deal with literally in my life, but also in my fiction. So there's just a different way of approaching a subject. That's not to say that these things have disappeared, and I don't mean to suggest at all that we are living in any kind of post-racial nation or world, but that certainly I don't have to feel like that everything I say, she's speaking for the black woman Southerner.
Speaking of the way things have changed, as an educator and an author whose life is the written word, how is the way we read and write as a society with the advent of technology, how has that changed and informed your approach, both as an educator and a writer?
There's I'm an old-fashioned storyteller. I really love stories. I think that it's very important to get into a character, to understand a character, to have that character go through something that people care about. And I don't think that that's changed. What's changed is how we communicate with each other. And I really feel like that we, even though we might tweet or we might send an email that has all lowercase letters or that kind of thing, that we still are hungry for stories. That's what we want. We want to understand people. So I don't feel like that storytelling in that way has changed significantly. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm not trying to say that the 19th century story is the same thing as the 20th century story, but in terms of approach or in terms of technique. But I do think that we are just hungry for stories. Even as faster and more efficient we get with our technology, we still want to know why.
Let's talk briefly about what you're doing next. We understand you're working on a book of essays about mental illness surrounding a murder that happened in the black community in North Carolina. We're back in North Carolina. Tell us about that briefly.
Well, I was wondering, there was a man in this community, and he was well known to be to have some mental illness. He wrote spray painted on his trailer. He would rant in the street. He would wear women's clothing and rant and accost people. So it was clear that there was a serious problem. But I think that the community felt like he's going to grow out of it. It's a phase. There's something that doesn't mean that he's mentally ill, or that doesn't mean that he's that bad. And of course, he committed a murder. He would have been a family annihilator had his children, thank goodness, they were not at home when the day that he decided to go on this rampage. So I started asking why, how did that happen? That this could go on. And people wouldn't understand it, or wouldn't intercede in some way, or that people would have the kinds of attitudes that they had. Oh, that's just Al, you know, that kind of thing. And there are lots of reasons for it, and some of the essays deal with that. There, you know, the Tuskegee experiment is if you don't know about it specifically, the idea that people are taking advantage of you is ripe in your mind.
Our guest is author Stephanie Powell Watts, who's also an assistant professor of English at Lehigh University. We've been talking about her collection of short stories titled We Are Taking Only What We Need, and also the difference between Missouri and her native North Carolina. And Adam and Gladstone reminds us that North Carolina, the major difference between the South and the Midwest is iced tea and barbecue are different. Glad we're going out on that note, because that's a very controversial subject. She'll be reading from her book at the Jazz Museum Atrium at 1616 East 18th Street in the 18th and Vine District. Stephanie Powell Watts, thank you for coming.
Thank you so much.
And tune in tomorrow when you'll find out why we have the marbles on this show to do a show about, wait for it, marbles. One of our guests holds the world record for the largest marble collection. Our show is produced by Andrew Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at the man behind Watergate and the motivations that drove his actions. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.